of disorder. This is because, as we have seen, the Roman, so-called Roman constitution of the Republic, the Mos Maiorum, as the Romans called it, the way of the ancestors, was just that. It was an assemblage of practices, accepted practices and patterns of behavior that allowed the Romans to govern the state in the way that they did. The legal potentialities of this or that office were not at the core of the Roman system of government, as we saw in previous lectures, but rather the patterns of behavior of those holding office was what was at the core of the Roman Republic. And so the Roman Revolution evolved. It was really a series of events in domestic and foreign affairs that built upon each other in a sequence of precedents that cumulatively had the effect of destroying the state. It isn't really any one or other of them that is decisive. It's the cumulative effect, snowball effect, of the whole period that brings the Roman Republic to an end. So it is a complicated story. I'll hope to guide you through it with the maximum degree of clarity as best I can. But we will be seeing, it's worth saying right now, an interaction often of domestic and foreign affairs. Our main focus will be on the domestic results of this interaction, but we will have to occasionally divert our attention to the provinces of the Roman Empire where events were taking place that were to impinge on the course of the Roman Revolution. The starting point for the revolution is clear to us, and that is the tribunate in 133 BC of Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus. This man was of plebeian family, but definitely a member of the new nobility in the Roman Senate. His father had been a prominent man, twice consul and indeed censor, and had served the state with a great degree of eminence. And Gracchus then, as a young nobleman, was on the road to a prominent public career himself. Gracchus was aware of the problem that we looked at the end of the last lecture that was afflicting the Italian countryside and impacting on the issue of manpower in the Roman army, namely the decline of the smallholder in the Roman countryside and his replacement with large estates owned by rich senators and sometimes equestrians worked by slaves. Gracchus determined that he would fix this problem. And when he became tribune of the plebs in 133 BC, he proposed a land bill, a land reform bill, which aimed at fixing this problem. And in forcing this bill through against heated opposition, he initiated the beginning of the Roman Revolution. Undoubtedly, he did so unwittingly, but nonetheless, the events of the first 6 months of 133 BC warrant close inspection. Gracchus's bill wasn't terribly revolutionary in and of itself. It focused on what was called public land, ager publicus, which was to say that land that was in Italy, which the Romans had taken control of as they expanded their state, and which was not assigned to one or other of the subject peoples. This land was then owned by the entire Roman people. By a law of 367 BC, there was a limit placed on how much of this type of land any one private citizen could own. The limit was, in Roman terms, 500 jugera, which is a measurement of area. 500 jugera is equivalent to about 320-odd acres. This law had been on the books since the mid-4th century BC, but had been ignored. People had simply not paid attention to it. And as a result, large amounts of public land were in the hands of rich landowners, far beyond the legally prescribed limit. What Gracchus proposed to do with this land bill was really enforce that law, revive that original law. He proposed that citizens who held excessive amounts of public land would have the surplus beyond the 500 jugera limit confiscated, and that surplus land would then be redistributed to the landless masses, the dispossessed smallholders who were accumulating in numbers in Rome, as now members of the headcount. The law was certainly a disadvantage to the rich. People would lose tracts of land that they'd had, perhaps in some cases, for generations in the family. On the other hand, its intentions were honorable. And patriotic senators, patriotic noblemen may well have supported it. In addition, Gracchus had eminent support in the Senate. He was a well-connected person. As I say, his father had been a very prominent man. His father-in-law was the princeps senatus, which is sort of the equivalent of the Speaker of the House, the oldest living senator who got the right of speaking first on all issues. And his mother, for instance, as well, was the daughter of Scipio Africanus, the defeater of Hannibal. So he was well-connected, had plenty of noble relations that he could call on for support. And the normal course of events would have been for Tiberius to bring his bill first before the Senate for discussion with the issuance of a decree, and then for that decree, that piece of advice from the Senate to be taken to the people for enactment as a law. Before looking at the actual course of events, I should mention that one of the issues that has greatly focused the attention of scholars has been that of Tiberius's motives. What motivated him to take on this job of land reform? There are those who argue that Tiberius was a genuine altruistic reformer. For instance, in the Soviet Union, Tiberius was often seen as the first communist. Here he is trying to take away the land of the rich and redistribute it to the poor and so on. Of course, this is nonsense. There were no communists in ancient Rome, that's for sure. But there are those who do argue here's a genuine reformer seeking to deal with a genuine problem in the Roman state. Basically, Tiberius the good guy. There are those who see Tiberius in quite the opposite light. Tiberius Gracchus is a revolutionary working for his own benefit, always seeking to gain the most number of, for instance, clients for himself. All the people to whom land was distributed by Tiberius Gracchus's land bill would become clients of Tiberius Gracchus and his family. And he couldn't have been unaware of this. And so here we have Tiberius the revolutionary. He's been painted in widely differing ways. Well, there's no reason why such motives are mutually exclusive. There's no reason why Tiberius Gracchus can't be seen as a typical Roman politician who had a genuine sense that the smallholder of ancient Rome had been badly treated and aggrieved, that this was having a negative impact on Roman manpower and wanted to fix that, while also having an eye on the benefits to himself and his family that would accrue from fixing this problem. So the issue of motives is one I just want to mention, since it's one of the things that has really drawn the attention of both ancient and modern analysts of Tiberius alike. In your further readings, no doubt, you'll see much discussion of this issue. Anyhow, to return to the sequence of events of the year 133 BC, Tiberius then should have taken his proposal to the Senate. He didn't. He bypassed the Senate. He took his bill, as was his right as a tribune, directly to the tribal assembly of the plebs. Now, there were certainly precedents for such behavior. Tribunes could take certain types of bill to their assembly without going to the Senate. But for a bill this contentious, this was definitely an inflammatory act. For whatever reason, Tiberius bypassed the Senate. The Senate responded with a clever ploy. They contracted one of Tiberius's tribunal colleagues, Marcus Octavius. Remember, there were 10 tribunes every year. They contracted one of his colleagues, Marcus Octavius, to veto Tiberius's bill. This would have ended the bill, killed it dead in its tracks. At this point, by the standards, the normal standards of behavior in the Roman Republic, Gracchus should have just backed down. He should have seen the strength of opposition and the veto of his colleague and backed down. He didn't. He entreated Octavius, we hear, this is a very dramatic moment, entreated Octavius to withdraw his veto. Remember, this is all taking place in person, all 10 tribunes on the speaker's platform, in the forum, with the mob out in front watching. This is very public, it's almost political theatre. He entreated him with tears, we hear, clasping at his knees. Please withdraw your veto. Octavius refused. Tiberius then said, well, you should resign your tribunate, since you are no longer acting in the interests of the people, and that's your mandate as a tribune of the people. Octavius refused. Tiberius said, we'll meet again, and called a assembly for some days hence, at which he proposed to the people a bill that would depose Marcus Octavius from his tribunate by order of the people, on the argument that he was no longer a tribune of the plebs, as he was acting against the interests of the plebs. A very dramatic scene ensued. Remember, voting proceeded by tribal units, 35 of them in this particular assembly, and stopped when a majority of 18 was reached. Voting proceeded to 17 tribes voting for the deposing of Marcus Octavius. Tiberius called a halt to the proceedings and entreated Octavius one last time to withdraw his veto before the last vote was taken. Octavius, we hear, tears in his eyes, looked at Tiberius and then looked over his shoulder at the solid mass of senators looking down upon proceedings from outside the Senate House. Here were his masters. He refused to withdraw his veto. The voting proceeded, and Octavius was deposed from his tribunate and dragged ignominiously from the Speaker's platform. This was a shocking act, totally without precedent in the Roman state. Tiberius Gracchus, in deposing Octavius, had undermined one of the core principles of Roman office-holding, collegiality. You always had a colleague who could veto your proceedings. The idea of ousting or deposing a colleague who vetoed your proceedings had not been thought of before and was distinctly revolutionary. Gracchus's land bill, with the veto now removed, Gracchus's land bill was passed into law. The Senate, however, had its hands on the purse strings of the Roman state, and they refused to fund the bill. The bill would have required a board of three men to travel around Italy. Remember again, Roman magistrates carried out all their actions in person. This would have meant that the people, Tiberius Gracchus and his colleagues in the land commission, were to travel around Italy, survey the land themselves, confiscate the surplus, go through the process of redistribution themselves. The Senate voted them a pittance to fund that activity, 10 cents a day. At this point, historical contingency comes into play. It looks like they had reached an impasse and Tiberius's land bill wasn't going to get anywhere. But news came from Asia that King Attalus of Pergamum had died childless, and he had left his kingdom as a bequest to the people of Rome. The kingdom of Pergamum, basically northwestern Turkey, was now to become a new province, the province of Asia. Tiberius pounced. He proposed a bill to the people that part of the new income from the province be diverted to fund his land commission. In one stroke, he insinuated the mob into the two unchallenged areas of senatorial dominance, financial and foreign affairs. The land commission then proceeded to do its work, and Tiberius, however, wasn't finished. He figured that there wasn't enough time left in his tribunate to oversee the implementation of his bill, and he let it be known that he would stand for a second tribunate for the following year of 132 BC. He was now attacking the other core principle of office holding at Rome, limited tenure of office. The perception could now be drawn from Tiberius's actions that he was aiming at nothing less than demagoguery, tyranny of the people. If you're a Roman nobleman, you could see how this perception would be quite clear. Now we have the image in the minds of some of the people, with tribunes at their heads, passing laws, ignoring the Senate, tribunes who can depose other tribunes who veto them, tribunes who can be re-elected apparently indefinitely every year. We're looking at tyranny. Tensions are running very high indeed. At a political rally on the Capitol Hill, Tiberius Gracchus and his followers were gathering to discuss the strategy of the elections, which would take place in the summer, in the course of July. Senatorial spies were watching proceedings. The Senate was waiting in the nearby meeting house, waiting for news. At one point, the crowd surged and Tiberius Gracchus felt himself under some pressure, raised his hand to his head as a sign to indicate to his friends that he was feeling some danger. The senatorial spies read the sign differently, ran down to the Senate and informed the senators that Gracchus was calling for a crown. Groups of senators, horrified at the prospect of a return to monarchy, rushed forward from the Senate House, broke up some benches that were traditionally used as part of the gatherings at political meetings, and with the bench legs, they beat Tiberius Gracchus and 300 of his followers to death. Gracchus's body was not given a decent burial, but was thrown like that of a common criminal's into the Tiber. Whatever his motives, Tiberius Gracchus' legacy to the Republic was absolutely appalling. He had utterly transgressed all the boundaries of accepted behavior in the course of his tribunate. This is all in the space of less than 6 months. He had refused to back down in the face of opposition, transgressing the concept of concordia, of harmony, maintaining harmony in the state. He had deposed an opposing colleague. He had insinuated the mob into the traditional preserves of senatorial governance in finances and foreign affairs. He had undermined the concept of limited tenure of office by proposing to stand for the tribunate of the following year. And even worse than that, the senators themselves had left a dreadful precedent for the future. One can solve one's domestic political disputes by killing one's opponents. These two legacies are the two most pronounced from Tiberius Gracchus's tribunate. A new way forward was pointed to ambitious politicians. You use the people, use tribunes and the tribal assembly of the plebs to advance your case, and even worse, kill your political opponents. Once introduced into Roman politics, violence in particular was not to leave for over a century. In the years following Tiberius Gracchus's tribunate, the Land Commission did its work unopposed, clearly a sign that the Senate was more horrified, more appalled at Tiberius Gracchus's methods than at his proposed land bill. It seems that it was doing its work well, since census figures for these years preserved in Livy indicate that the number of citizens with land increased in the years following 133 BC. But precisely 10 years after the introduction of Tiberius's land bill, in 123 BC and again in 122, trouble erupted again in the Roman state, and Gracchus was once more at the heart of it. This was Gaius Sempronius Gracchus, the younger brother of Tiberius. Obviously now with no love of the Senate, he was seething with vengeance on the people who had murdered his brother. He became tribune of the people in 123 BC, and again in 122, it must be stated that in the interim, a law had been passed allowing people to stand for successive tribunates within reason. It's not that they could keep doing it for a decade or more, but they could hold one or two or three if they wished. Gracchus is more difficult. Gaius Gracchus is more difficult than Tiberius Gracchus. Tiberius was motivated by a single issue, which he cleaved to and forced through as best he could. But Gaius Gracchus isn't. During his tribunates, he passed a whole wide range of bills on a variety of different matters. He appears to have been more of a firebrand than his brother, more openly anti-senatorial. For instance, we hear that at political meetings, he was the first one who would address the people turning his back on the Senate rather than facing the Senate, this being a symbolic move. He was an extremely emotional and powerful public speaker, and could rouse up support for himself in a variety of ways. In other words, he was more of an open demagogue than Tiberius had been. His legislation, which we can't go into in detail, there's just too much of it, so far as we can make it out, his legislation seems to have been aimed at garnering as much support for himself as he could from a variety of sources. He proposes laws, for instance, to benefit the mob. He proposes that cheap grain be sold to the people, that grain be sold to the mob below the market price. He proposes various road and building works to give the people employment. He also proposes the founding of overseas colonies. One of the places that he wanted to found was Carthage, sitting vacant since 146, an extremely excellent site for a city, and, you know, the Romans weren't silly, they could see the advantages of that site. And he proposed, though, to found colonies overseas to help the landless of the city. So here's just a series. I'm just giving you some samples of the sorts of legislation that Gaius Gracchus issued. These measures then seem to be for the people, for the knights, for the equestrian class. He proposed various fiscal measures that would benefit them in their commercial enterprises. He also proposed to give them some political power for the first time by giving them control over extortion courts. Extortion courts were those courts established to scrutinize the behavior of governors, proconsuls and propraetors, senators all, who had been away in their provinces and were suspected of financial mischief in their provinces. These courts were currently all staffed, the juries were all staffed by fellow senators. Gaius then proposed to staff these juries in the extortion courts with knights rather than senators, effectively giving the knights a political stick to wield over the senators. And in fact, it was precisely over provincial affairs that senators and knights found themselves most at loggerheads. Remember, the knights were the ones in charge of the tax farming in the provinces, and the senators were the ones in charge of maintaining the order as the governors of the province. Of course, excessively extortionate tax farming by knights could lead to disorder in the province. So there had been cases where proconsuls and propraetors and the publicani, the tax farmers, had found themselves in dispute. Now Gracchus was proposing that it would be essentially the publicani who would sit in judgment of future governors charged with extortion in the provinces, and so gave them quite a big political stick to beat the Senate with. These measures seemed to be then designed to garner the support of the knights. And he also proposed, or seemed to be going to the Italian allies as a further basis for his support. The issue of rights for the Italian allies, especially the enfranchisement of the Italians, making them full citizens, had become a heated one in the course of the 120s BC. Many Italian allies felt that they had done their due expanding the Roman Empire. They had fought 50% of all Roman armies made up of Italian allies. They had felt that they had performed sufficiently for Rome and now deserved to be fully enfranchised as Roman citizens. The Roman people, however, seemed to have changed in their attitude towards sharing citizenship somewhat. They more jealously guarded their citizenship now and were unwilling to support the allies in this. And so when Gaius Gracchus proposed the enfranchisement of all states that had Latin rights, he made himself unpopular with the mob. But he seems clearly to have been aiming at garnering the wider support of the Italian allies. Presumably, if all those allies had become voting citizens, they would vote for Gracchus. The Senate, this time, did not try to veto Gracchus's reforms. They tried a different tactic. For the year 122 BC, Marcus Livius Drusus became a tribune of the plebs. And rather than vetoing Gaius Gracchus's various measures, the Senate outbid him for popularity. "Why have cheap grain," said Drusus, "when you can have free grain? Why have a handful of colonies across the ocean when we can have one dozen of them in Italy itself? You won't have to even travel that far from home." The allies, he realized that the issue of the enfranchisement of the allies was unpopular with the mob. He didn't outbid Gracchus in that, but he proposed some other mollifying measures that the allies be treated better in the army and not be subject to summary beatings and so forth as they had been to date. So he attempted to undermine Gracchus's popularity with the various sectors of the society that Gracchus was trying to garner for himself. It worked. The mob deserted Gaius Gracchus, especially over the issue of enfranchisement of the allies. He became less popular, and although he had been elected as tribune of the plebs in 123 and again in 122, he failed to gain election as tribune of the plebs for 121. Tensions now mounted. Gracchus would undoubtedly be facing prosecution for his behaviour. His political enemies would be attempting to pounce on him now that he was out of office. This, by the way, is an issue that the Romans had no doubt about, unlike our modern countries. A sitting magistrate was not liable to prosecution, but as soon as the magistracy lapsed, he was. We'll see this issue rising again, especially with Caesar. Anyhow, the situation towards the end of 122 and into 121 gets very tense indeed. Gracchus took to being escorted by a surreptitiously armed bodyguard. It was illegal to carry daggers and knives and swords inside the boundary of Rome, but you could carry pens. Roman pens were called styli, and they were essentially narrow spikes, often made out of metal, sometimes out of ivory, narrow spikes with the flat end for writing on wax tablets. They could make quite effective weapons. And Gracchus had them, had his guards armed in this fashion. At a political rally for Gracchus, with tensions running high, one of the slaves of the consul for 121 BC, a man called Gaius Opimius, issued an insult in the direction of Gracchus's supporters. We hear that Gaius Gracchus cast him an evil glance, at which point some of Gracchus's supporters took that as a sign that they should act. And they murdered the unfortunate man. They murdered the slave. The consul now saw fit to act. He proposed that Gracchus was a revolutionary. He urged the Senate to act promptly before they faced a tyranny. For the first time in Roman history, the Senate passed a decree called the Senatus Consultum Ultimum, the ultimate decree of the Senate. It essentially established martial law. It ordered the consuls to do whatever it took to maintain order and preserve the liberty of the state. The consul, Gaius Opimius, armed his personal attendants and slaves, and essentially a full-scale riot broke out in the center of Rome. Street fighting in which Gaius Gracchus was decapitated and 3,000 of his followers killed. Gaius Gracchus followed his brother down the Tiber. The legacy of the Gracchi brothers was an appalling one. The situation in Rome, the old accepted consensus of patterns of behavior, had been washed away completely. They had challenged the authority of the Senate. And we'll see at the beginning of the next lecture how this became, to a degree, crystallized in Roman politics in following years. They had indicated a new route to power for the ambitious young politician. The tribal assembly of the plebs, led by ambitious, able, firebrand tribunes. And they had paid a heavy price for challenging the Senate's authority. But on both occasions, the Senate had set the worst precedent. On both occasions, it was the Senate who had resorted to violence. And it was, as I said before, it was violence that was to be the ultimate undoing of the Roman Republic.
Lecture 21, Marius and Sulla.
Hello again, and welcome to the History of Rome, and Lecture 21. We have now embarked on our analysis of the Roman Revolution, a term, I should explain, coined by modern scholars, not applied to the period by the Romans themselves, but coined by modern scholars to describe this period that we're examining of increasing disorder and violence in the Roman state. The last time we saw the beginnings of this process with the tribunates of Tiberius and then of Gaius Gracchus in 133 and again in 123 and 122 BC. And today I want to pick up the tale 10 or so years after the death of Gaius Gracchus in 121 BC. The intervening years had been relatively quiet, and it was in 111 BC that events got underway which were to start the rise to power of the next major protagonist in the process of dissolution, Gaius Marius. So we will look at the careers of Marius and then of Sulla, Lucius Cornelius Sulla, the next protagonist of the empire, who was an opponent of Marius, and their careers overlap, so we will look at each of them in turn. But before doing so, I just want to emphasize a general point about what had happened in Roman politics as a result of the careers of the Gracchi brothers. We had seen the last time that one of the major legacies of the Gracchi brothers to Roman politics was pointing a new way of doing things for the ambitious, namely the use of tribunes of the plebs, taking bills directly to the tribal assembly of the plebs, the Concilium Plebis, to get legislation enacted and to effect a political agenda. This new route was followed in the years following the Gracchi brothers to such a degree that it was recognized by the Romans themselves as a method of doing politics. And they called their process popularitur agere, which means to behave in a popular way, to behave in a way that appeals to the people. And they called the men who did it men of the people, populares. The men of the people were in opposition to the more conservative element in the Senate, especially, who looked to the older way, the more traditional ways of running the state, primarily with the Senate as the dominant body. These men abrogated the term the best ones for themselves. They called themselves the optimates. I must stress that these are not political parties in the modern sense. There is, to a degree, an ideological division between them, but it's not really a division founded in any theory or firmly rooted ideology. It's more a division based on methods. Which route do you take? Do you take the traditional route of applying through the Senate and using the influence of the chief men of the state as gathered in the Senate? Or do you take the new route of going straight to the people as a tribune or using a tribune? You didn't necessarily be a tribune yourself, but you can use a tribune to access the legislative power of the tribal assembly of the plebs directly. As a result then, populares tended to strike a certain pose. They would propose legislation that would be popular to the people. They would often denigrate the Senate as an institution and pose as champions of the people, whether or not they actually genuinely felt that. They certainly aren't left-wing communists or revolutionaries who were trying to overturn the state and create some kind of a egalitarian utopia. Nothing like that. Really, the division between the populares and the optimates is one of method. And we'll see it used again and again as the revolution proceeds. Gaius Marius was a new man. He was a homo novus from what, for the Roman established nobility, would have been the Styx, the country backwoods, a town of Arpinum in Italy. He seems to have had a connection, his family seems to have had a connection with a major Roman family of the Caecilii Metelli, who were a leading family in Rome and may have indeed been the patrons of Marius's family. And his early career was lackluster in the extreme. He didn't seem to be going anywhere in particular. He got elected to some offices, failed to be elected to the aedileship, and only barely scraped in as a praetor in 115 BC. So he was really a very mediocre looking chap, and nobody in 115 BC would have thought that this man was going to be of any particular prominence. Marius, however, chose the military route, which was, of course, as we've seen, one of the chief avenues, fast tracks to prominence in the Roman Republic. He chose the military route for himself and saw his opportunity in Numidia. The kingdom of Numidia, broadly speaking, equivalent to modern-day Algeria, had come under the wing of Rome during the Second Punic War. In Numidia, in 111 BC, however, a war broke out due to internal dynastic machinations that we won't trouble ourselves with. A king of Numidia, a man called Jugurtha, behaved in a way that was contrary to various decrees of the Senate and the wishes of the Roman people. Jugurtha, through a combination of military cleverness and general elusiveness in the field and mass acts of bribery when he went to Rome to plead his case, he's reported on one occasion on leaving the city to have said words to the effect of, "There's a city in which everything and everyone is for sale," had dragged the war on from 111 BC for 4 years. Marius, who was serving as a minor officer in this war in Numidia, figured that he knew what he could do to bring it to a swift end. And he stood and was elected for the consulship of 107 BC on precisely that promise to the people. "I'll end the war in 1 year," he said. He didn't quite end it in 1 year, it took him 2 years. But he did do a swift job on Jugurtha. Jugurtha was cornered, defeated, and eventually captured, physically captured, alive, and brought to Rome in 105 BC. Marius was elected as consul for a second time in 105 to complete the war. I should point out that the capture of Jugurtha from a neighboring native king, a king called with a wonderful name, King Bacchus of Mauritania, which is essentially modern-day Morocco. Bacchus had handed Jugurtha over to one of Marius's officers, a quaestor serving in Marius's army in 105 BC, a man called Lucius Cornelius Sulla. Marius, in 105 BC then, is the people's military hero. He had promised to bring the Jugurthine War to a swift end, and he had followed through on his promise. And fortunately for Marius, a new military threat was looming in the north. For the first time, Romans had encountered Germans. The Romans dealing with the people of northern Europe had been rather limited. They had dealt, as we'd seen, with the Gauls of the Po Valley. They had in fact conquered the Gauls and annexed the Po Valley as Gallia Cisalpina in 220 BC. And they'd also had dealings with the Gauls of southern France for some years since their acquisition of territories in Spain, since the land route to their territories in Spain needed to be secured. They had had dealings in the south of France, and in fact in 121 BC had formed a new province, which they called, rather unimaginatively, Gallia Transalpina, Gaul across the Alps. This basically is the area of southern France that is to this day called Provence, the province. Anyhow, their dealings with the tribal peoples of the north had been restricted primarily to the Celts. But in the course of the late 2nd century BC, German tribes, apparently from the region of modern-day Denmark, who had been driven out of their homes, two massive migrations of people called the Teutones and the Cimbri, had made their way through Gaul and were now flanking and bordering, moving around on the edge of Roman territory in southern France. Armies sent out against them had met with ignominious defeat. And most alarmingly, a large force under the command of a proconsul and a consul, a joint proconsular and consular army, had been crushed and nearly everyone in the army slaughtered at a huge battle at the Battle of Arausio in 105 BC. By the way, this battle is a good example of why the Romans had the dictatorship. The two commanders, the proconsul and the consul, hated each other and refused to cooperate. They split their forces, and as a result, when the Germans came on, they were annihilated in detail. In any case, this caused widespread panic in Rome. Memories of the Gallic incursion of 390 came surging back. My God, Rome is open to the smelly hordes of northern Europe. What to do? On hand is Gaius Marius, the military hero of the people. In an unprecedented move, he finds himself elected to three more consulships in 104, 103 and 102 BC. That means in the 6 years between 107 and 102 BC, Gaius Marius has been consul for five of them. He raises a new army, trains it, and goes up into southern France to take on the German threat. He crushes the Teutones at a huge battle in 102 BC at a place called Aquae Sextiae, which is Aix-en-Provence today. And the Cimbri were defeated by Marius's consular colleague, by the consul of 101 BC. Marius was not consul in 101. But the consul of 101 BC, with the assistance of Marius, crushed the other wing of the German threat, the Cimbri, at the Battle of Vercellae in 101. Marius was now the chief man of Rome. He was a military popular hero, catapulted to prominence by virtue of his military successes. In 100 BC, he was elected once more to a consulship, his sixth consulship since the year 107. As we'll see, however, he was not nearly as sharp a politician as he was a soldier. More of the details of 100 BC in a minute. Marius, to effect his victories, effected a number of military reforms within the nature of the Roman army. For instance, he did away with maniples and created instead a larger units called cohorts. He also moved the army towards greater degree of professionalization. He created, for instance, standing legions. So although the army would be raised as needed, the number of legions was kept the same. That is to say that you would have a fifth legion and a sixth legion and a seventh legion and so forth, which allowed a sense of unit identity to evolve, unit history to evolve. He was also the one who brought standards, golden eagles, as symbols of the legion's identity to the Roman army. This gave the army, even though it was again raised ad hoc, this gave the army a broader sense of identity and continuity and history and so forth, and would lead to units competing with each other for bravery on the field. It made it a more effective fighting force. But Marius did something else that was to have much broader effects. To fight his war against Jugurtha, he felt it necessary to enlist from the Roman mob the landless headcount, the Capitacensi. He figured this was a large, untapped pool of manpower that could be used. These men were to be equipped at state expense, and their inducement for fighting was the promise of a land grant upon dismissal, upon demobilization at the end of the campaign. He did this again for his campaigns against the Germans. Now, the Romans had enlisted slaves and people who fell below the property qualification for military service in times of great crisis. What's different with Marius is that he makes it a standard practice. His armies that fought against Jugurtha and fought against the Germans were armies of landless Romans, fighting now as much for their own benefit as for anything else. And if we think about it, the effect of this change was remarkable. It essentially politicized the Roman military. Since they looked to their general, the rank and file soldiers looked to their general as their patron. He was the one with the political connections who, when the war was over, could secure them their land and their rewards for service. What was the Roman state to a landless member of the headcount? The res publica romana was nothing in particular, a name, a concept. But Gaius Marius, here's a guy who can help us. And Marius unwittingly then created a politicized Roman military, a military made up of landless soldiers who looked to their generals, who directed their loyalties towards their generals rather than towards any vague notion of Rome. The events of Marius' sixth consulship in 100 BC illustrate both his incompetence as a politician and something of the ramifications, which he doesn't seem to have appreciated, of this change in the enlistment procedures for the Roman army. Marius used the tribune, a man called Lucius Appuleius Saturninus, to pass land bills in 103 BC to settle the veterans from his war against Jugurtha. In 100 BC, he also used the same tribune, who was tribune again in 100, Lucius Appuleius Saturninus, to try and force through legislation giving land for his veterans from the German campaigns. The legislation met with some opposition. On the day of the meetings, just prior to the day of the Comitia to establish and vote for these measures, Appuleius sent around heralds to the country folk and urged them to come into town to vote on this day. Many of these country folk were Marius' veterans from his previous wars. They came to town ready for action. At the actual assembly, the city folk, it seems, country and city rivalries are always being what they are today, I suppose, took exception to the attitude of the country voters, hitched up their togas, broke up the benches that were around, and attacked them in a riot. The country folk responded with staves and whatever wood they could find, and the whole committee broke up into an abject riot. The law was passed, however, and Marius' veterans got their land. Marius was now associated with this character, Saturninus. But Saturninus had his own agenda, and Marius did not realize it. Saturninus had another partner in crime, a man who was praetor in 100 BC, and whom he wanted to be elected as consul for the following year. Together, Saturninus and his other partner, a man called Glaucia, were going to push through their own revolutionary agenda. However, one of the other consular candidates was much more popular with the mob than was Glaucia, Saturninus' partner. And shockingly, at the elections, when this more popular figure came forward to give his speech, agents of Saturninus assaulted him on the platform at the elections and stabbed him to death. This is where we're at now. This is the stage that we've reached in Roman politics. This is the legacy of the Gracchi manifest. The people were incensed at such behavior, and Saturninus and his colleague were assaulted and had to take refuge on the Capitoline Hill. Marius, remember, is consul. The Senate passes the Senatus Consultum Ultimum, the declaration of martial law. Marius is now put in the position of having to turn on his former political ally. He's totally outmaneuvered politically. He's made look like a fool. Saturninus, by the way, and his colleagues were given a promise of safe passage off the Capitol, and as soon as they came down, they were attacked by the mob. They took refuge in the Senate House, where they were pelted to death with the tiles from the roof. Roman tiles, by the way, are about 2 feet by 2 feet and several inches thick. We're talking about large pieces of pottery raining down on these unfortunate men. They were effectively lynched. But more importantly, Marius was made look like a fool. He was made look untrustworthy, and he was made look like he had utterly failed, as he had, utterly failed to divine the true nature of his ally Saturninus, Apuleius Saturninus. He had completely failed to appreciate the true nature of this man's designs. As a result, after his consulship of 100 BC, Marius retired into relative obscurity and private life. Still a well-recognized figure in Rome, of course, but not a prominent figure throughout the 90s. The baton now passes to Sulla. Sulla was a patrician. Unlike Marius, he's not a new man. He's from a well-established, if impoverished, patrician family. He has a very high sense of his heritage, of his patrician heritage, and his nobility. He'd served with Marius against Jugurtha, as we'd seen, and also he served with them in the German campaigns. He was a very effective officer. Sulla and Marius appeared to have been on relatively good terms until Marius failed to give Sulla his due credit for capturing Jugurtha in 105 BC. This is just the sort of thing that Roman politics centered around. Dignitas, one's reputation, one's face in the public eye. This was a slight, an insult to Sulla's reputation. And it seems from this point onwards, from the late 2nd century onwards, there was no love lost between Sulla and Marius. The issue, the political issue that was to prove the next bone of contention in the Roman Revolution, was the old one of the status of the allies. Since the time of the late 2nd century, petitioning for the full enfranchisement of the Italian allies had continued, and all efforts to carry it out had been blocked. The allies' patience was wearing very, very thin indeed. In 91 BC, a tribune of the people, Marcus Livius Drusus, son of the same tribune who had outbid Gaius Gracchus, prepared to pass a law to solve this issue for once and for all. He recognized it as a very incendiary, potentially disastrous issue facing the Roman state. Drusus, it seems, was a rather arrogant man and not well liked by his colleagues. And his stance on the issue of enfranchisement of the allies was not a popular one with the people. We've seen this, and the Roman people had become rather jealous of their citizenship and were not entirely willing to see all of the Italians raised up to the same level as themselves. As a result, for much of his tribunate, Drusus had to stay indoors for fear of violence. He did, however, nonetheless, to carry out his duties, have to physically show up at any meetings at which he wanted to set a date for a future vote, or put a proposal, or bring a bill. One couldn't do that from one's house. Remember again, it's a key point of the structural, institutional nature of the Roman state. Magistrates carry out their duties in public, and in person. So, on one of these meetings, Drusus comes out of his house, and on his way back, he's stabbed in the side and dies a few hours later. With Drusus dies his proposal to enfranchise the Italians. This is the last straw. Some of the allies, especially those who were descendants of the Samnites, are still in fact Samnites, is in the central part of Italy, south and west of Rome, take the demand for enfranchisement a step further. They rebel. And the goals of the allies, of these secessionist allies, change. Not only are they now fighting for enfranchisement, they're now fighting for free Italy. They form a new state, Italia, and they begin to fight for the removal of Roman power in Italy. In other words, in 91 BC, the Romans find themselves at war with their own allies. This war is called, for that reason, the social war, the war of the allies. The Latin for ally being socius. So the Bellum Sociale is the war with the allies. It's essentially a civil war, an Italian civil war. It's a needless and pointless campaign. The war is particularly violent and savage. The Romans, recall, had basically forced this war by jealously guarding their citizenship. Now they found themselves hard-pressed. Their own allies, men who they had fought beside, who were fully trained and equipped in the Roman fashion, and were therefore a formidable fighting force, were now at their doorsteps. It must be said that not all the Allies had turned on Rome. The core heartland of the Roman Confederacy around Latium stayed loyal. But it wasn't enough. Too much of Italy was in arms against them. And this is, to me, one of the great ironies of this war. In order to lure the Allies, or at least some of them, back, the Romans granted, within 1 year of the war starting, they granted the request that had started the war in the first place. They offered full citizenship to any of the now rebel allies who returned to loyalty with Rome. This was quite effective. It means that the war was completely pointless. If they'd done that in 91 BC, there wouldn't have been a war. As it turned out, they had to do it under crisis, under threat of destruction. The Allies, however, some of them had thrown their hat in too deeply with the issue of the secession from Rome. And while many of them now did in fact turn over and come back to the fold of the Roman Confederacy, the war lasted until 88 BC. It was a brutal conflict and saw Marius emerge out of retirement once more to take control of Roman forces in the north of Italy. Sulla, who had been praetor some years previously, was given the role of a pro-praetor. He was given pro-praetorian command over the southern part of Italy. So the two men didn't actually do a lot of meeting, but they did cooperate in taking care of the social war, of the allied war, in the respective halves of the peninsula, in the respective theatres of operation. Marius and Sulla then have come together to fight this war, and it proves to be an effective combination. Both men are very effective military leaders. The war is over by 88 BC. However, we'll see that events in the Eastern Mediterranean were to rise up to bring these men into conflict immediately after the end of the social war. That'll be the subject of our next lecture, but it's worth perhaps pausing at this point to just see the stage we've reached in the development of the Roman Revolution. It's perhaps worth doing this on a fairly frequent basis so we can analyse the status of affairs as we proceed through the facts. What had started out as a proposal for land reform had reached the stage now within a generation of the tribunate of Tiberius Gracchus of spiralling disorder. The committee meetings, the assemblies that took place in 100 BC are perfectly exemplary of this. It was now not uncommon to find popular assemblies, whether they were constituted for the purposes of voting or for discussing a proposal, to break up into a riot. It was not uncommon for tribunes of the people to have gangs, hired gangs of hooligans, street gangsters, in their employ to help force through legislation, to intimidate opponents, such as Livius Drusus, for instance, who felt he had to stay home for as long as he could for fear of going outside, and indeed his fears were proven absolutely right. When he did venture outside, he found himself stabbed to death. It wasn't uncommon as well, this is a very important point, for ambitious generals, men well connected, higher up in the Roman nobility, to use these tribunes and their hired gangs of hooligans and ruffians for their own purposes. In fact, this is a pattern that we'll see now increasingly more common in the Roman Revolution as we proceed. The use of tribunes by men in a greater position of influence for their own particular agenda, usually forcing through land bills for their armies, for their now landless armies, or forcing through other legislation that benefited themselves. This is a pattern that we will see again and again. The use of the popularist approach by men of higher rank. What we haven't seen yet, and what we will see in the next lecture in more detail, is the direct infusion of the Roman military into this whole scenario. What we have right now is really a situation of domestic civil disobedience, rioting, beatings, occasional political assassinations. What we haven't reached yet is the stage where Roman troops, under arms, Roman soldiers will be directly used in the conflicts between the leaders of the Roman state. That was the stage the next logical development of the Roman Revolution that was to be initiated by Sulla, and that was to take place, as I've said, in 88 BC, the very same year that the social war was brought to an end. But in Turkey, in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, a foreign king was carrying out actions that were to bring Sulla and Marius into direct conflict and lead to the first serious civil war.
Lecture 22, The Royal Rule of Sulla.
Welcome back to the History of Ancient Rome and the 22nd lecture in the series of 48. We are going to look today at the major escalation of events that took place in 88 BC and over the next 9 to 10 years or so, when the Roman general and politician Lucius Cornelius Sulla was dominant in the Roman state. We have seen already the development of the revolution from relatively innocuous roots to a situation involving increasing levels of disorder. Under Sulla, whole new depths of disorder were plumbed and opened for the Roman state. Our initial focus for Sulla must take us beyond Italy to Turkey, the kingdom of Pontus on the northern coast of Turkey, where during the course of the social war, when the Romans were busy fighting their own allies in Italy, in that needless conflict, a king of Pontus, a native kingdom but highly Hellenized, Mithridates VI, who called himself Eupator, the good father of his children, i.e. his subjects, a very young and ambitious man who had been in control of Pontus for some years, saw a chance. The Romans were not well liked in the eastern Mediterranean. Here is where the richest parts of the Mediterranean world were located, very affluent cities with a long history of culture behind them, and the depredations of Roman tax farmers and other extortionate members of the Roman ruling class who showed up there in the wake of Roman power being established in the East Mediterranean had not made the Romans especially popular with the people of the East Mediterranean. So in 89 BC, Mithridates VI took the opportunity of Rome's focus on matters Italian to seize control of many of Rome's holdings in the eastern part of the empire. He overran the province of Asia, and he positioned himself as a champion of the Greeks against Roman oppression. The ploy worked, and many of the Greek islands also defected to this new banner of rebellion against Rome. In a rather desperate measure, in 89 BC, after he had gained control over large sectors of Rome's eastern holdings, Mithridates issued a directive to those now in his control. The directive and the event that followed are often termed the Asiatic Vespers. In this directive, all Romans and Italians, be they soldiers or civilians, governors or businessmen, living in the islands and lands now controlled by Mithridates, were to be killed on a single day. According to our sources, some 80,000 people, men, women and children, perished on this occasion. Whatever about Mithridates' behavior in taking over and overrunning Roman interests in Asia, this act ensured that the wrath of Rome would be severe indeed, and that Mithridates would not be allowed rest until the Romans had dealt with him. News of the Mithridatic War reached Rome in 88 BC, just after the social war had been concluded, at a time when Sulla was consul for the first time. He had been praetor already, and so now, after excellent military service in the social war, he had been elected to the consulship for that year. It was the traditional practice of the Senate to assign provinces to consuls sitting in office, and the Senate assigned Sulla the war against Mithridates. Marius, however, lusted after the same command. He had a taste.